This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Well, she said nothing. Not one witness, not one argument, not even a closing Hail Mary from the witness stand. After weeks of evidence, texts, timelines, and spiritual fiction turned into courtroom reality, Lori Vallow Daybell simply rested her case without presenting a single shred of defense. Now, in a courtroom, that's not just a pin drop moment, that's a mic drop. And maybe a smoke bomb, depending on how you see it. So the million-dollar question here, besides the literal million in the life insurance, is what does it mean that a defendant just folds her arms and rests without a word? Is it a strategy? Is it a surrender? Is it confidence? Or is it just someone who knows there's no salvaging this ship? Of course, we're talking about Lori Vallow Daybell joining us now to discuss, criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis. Eric, when you have a defendant just like this, it doesn't matter to bother to defend themselves in a case like this. What message does that send the jury, to the judge, and everyone else watching along at home with their popcorn?
You know, Tony, like you said, I think there are multiple interpretations, but just from like a common sense human perspective, often the jury wants to see something from the defense. They've heard all the prosecution witnesses. They've heard the cross-examination and, you know, the defense's attempt to undermine those witnesses. But usually the jury is like, okay, what's coming from this side? What can you show me that is going to sway my opinion in this case? And here there was no such showing.
Were you surprised that Lori decided not to do anything, not to go and take her turn as the defense? I believe she had witnesses on a list, but last minute decides not to go any further. What do you think happened here?
Yeah, you know, it's a little hard to glean. You know, when you're dealing with other attorneys, an attorney on the other side of the case, you can kind of play chess with them because you can anticipate their moves. You can sort of think, hey, what are they thinking? What strategy do they have? And how do I counter that? When you have a pro se defendant, that goes out the window. And it's hard to really, you know, think into why did they do this and what was their objective? I wonder if it was just sort of a lack of competence or if it was that she feels supremely confident that the government hasn't proven their case.
That's the big question, because at the very end where the judge said, are you going to be presenting a case? She kind of reservedly said, nope. I rest. And I'm wondering, was that a spontaneous moment of Lori kind of like doing a F you to everybody? Or is it, you know, was she really planning on doing that? I couldn't read if it was spontaneous, crazy, or what at that moment in time. Do you think this is part of her strategy all along?
Well, you know, a seasoned trial tactician would make that call on the fly usually, especially in terms of whether the defendant is going to testify. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the attorney knows whether they're going to call their own witnesses on the defense's behalf. But here, you know, Lori is kind of flying by the seat of her pants. She has made a valiant effort here and there on some of this questioning. But I wonder if it was just kind of, you know, reading the writing on the wall or just kind of being done with this entire process and feeling some air of resignation.
Yeah, like maybe she doesn't want to play the game anymore. Like, I'm done. I'm going to take my toys home. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. She's in prison for the rest of her life. But, I mean, it does matter to those who lost Charles and to Brandon Boudreau, who was shot at. You know, it does make a difference to some folks. Do you think that the state met its burden of proof? Because at the end of the day, we did not ever hear anything that definitively, literally says, let's kill Charles. It was in code. That's certainly there. But is that code enough to say that it was, you know, completely that's what the goal was? Or is, obviously, she still has closing arguments, so she can bring up something there. I wonder if she's going to say, well, Nephi meant something other than what you guys are interpreting it to be. What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, this was not a slam dunk case for the prosecution from the beginning, in my opinion. You know, in order to prove conspiracy to commit murder, you got to prove there was an agreement between two people and that Lori took an overt act in furtherance of that agreement to kill Charles Vallow. Here we have some coded spiritual language, the Nephi thing. I guess he was a religious figure who justified murder. So, of course, that's problematic. But one thing that I didn't see was Alex's assent to whatever offer Lori might have been making. And then also, what was Lori's overt act? Just you know, asking for a parental exchange of the child at a place and then Alex shoots the guy? Is that enough to get us there? I would be astounded if Lori beats this, but there's at least a chance she might.
You know, there is. It's not a trial of her personality. And that's what, you know, it seems like in a lot of cases it ends up being. It certainly seems like it over in Karen Reedland. But this one, it's not. We knew she was going to come across crazy. And she certainly succeeded at that. But yeah, at the end of the day, crazy doesn't necessarily make a murderer, even though we know that she is to her kids and everything else. But yeah, here... I don't know. I mean, I do know, but I don't know. I don't know that a jury will see it that way. I feel like there really could be a possibility here that reasonable doubt does come into play. Were you thinking that the prosecution was going to have something a little more finite, a little more, you know, the hits today or something in some sort of message, not just weird coded biblical text?
You know, I thought that there would be a more extensive presentation of evidence. I thought the trial would be longer. Mm-hmm. There'd be more witnesses. There'd be more pieces of evidence admitted to be brought back to the jury. This was a rather lean trial presentation mm-hmm. by the government. And I think whether intentionally or not, Lori made a good call by not testifying, because if she would have testified, those prior convictions for killing her children would likely have come in. I'm not necessarily the details surrounding them, but I think that she would have shot herself in the foot and sealed her fate. Now her fate is kind of an open question on this case.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And yeah, you're exactly right. Had she gone more forward, she came close already to having the kids being brought into this. She was walking that fine line, and the judge stopped her several times. Let me ask you this. Yes, Lori is her own attorney. She chose that herself. It wasn't any sort of forcibly, you know, you don't get an attorney, Lori. She chose it. The judge really held her hand through all of this. Was it too much? I mean, it was almost like you're looking at an injured animal and you're like, oh, let me help you along. But it's court. She's up for a murder charge. And I mean, if you let her go, the kids would already be in this. And there's other things that I'm sure would have ended up getting in based on her loose lips. Was that a bit much, in your opinion, for the judge holding the hand as much as she did of Lori?
You know, most jurisdictions, if they don't have an express rule, they have a common understanding that judges are going to give significant leeway and deference to a pro se litigant, just because the pro se person doesn't know what they're doing. And the court system doesn't want that inexperience to be the reason for a conviction. So I totally agree. This judge was really kind of playing patty cake with her and giving her some doing her some favors here and there. But that's rather common to see when there is a pro se litigant. And I would note this judge was incredibly understanding and patient throughout the whole process.
Would it have been creating appellate issues at the end of the day if he didn't reach out his hand and help her so much? I mean, she is her own attorney. She's making her own decisions. Shouldn't you just have to lie in the bed that you create? I know, you know, that's not usually how it works, but I mean, I don't know. To me, it did feel like a bit much, but I get what you're saying, that it could have been an appellate issue. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, Lori really could have made any number of errors. And the judge was sort of guiding her away from that, steering her away from something that could open the door to the children coming in. Certainly when there's a pro se litigant and there's a conviction, there can be a slew of appellate grounds brought once that appeal is lodged. And so I think the judge was being extra careful here to try and avoid any such appeal, because this judge wants finality if there ever is a conviction, and that it not be overturned.
How do you think, I mean, obviously we know this case, we've watched it, we know the ins and outs of a lot of it. The jury, you know, it supposedly they don't know it that well, enough that they can be, you know, people who can decide this thing without any sort of prejudice. But with what they heard in that courtroom, basically the one side of everything with Lori and Nephi and Chad and all sorts of just, you know, crazy shit. Do you think they're walking away thinking that she's as crazy as she is, considering how she did present herself in court? She did present herself, I think, better than expected, but it didn't really go that far into crazy land. We went into some jealousy over a girl who dated Charles right before he died. That was kind of weird. But we didn't get preaching. We didn't get anything like that, at least not yet. There's still one more stage to stand on with the closing arguments. But I wonder how much Lori is looking as crazy as the rest of us see her, as the jury does here.
Tony, totally true. And I wonder if the jury is experiencing even some cognitive dissonance around this. Mm-hmm. You know, they see the evidence, which paints Lori as, you know, being out of touch and having these fantastical notions of otherworldly things, and she's sort of way out there. And then you see how she does in trial, and there wasn't much of that, like you said. So I wonder if the jury is thinking to themselves, like, is Lori able to turn this off and on? What is the explanation for the contrast between presentations of Lori in the evidence and then her own presentation at trial? That's going to be something the jury is grappling with.
Obviously, one of the things that doesn't make her look very good is the phone call to get the life insurance money pretty quick after he died. But again, if you have a spouse and there's a life insurance policy and, you know, there's a funeral coming up, you're going to have to pay for that. There's expenses that come along with things of that nature. And I don't know what her financial situation was, but some could argue that, yeah, I mean, maybe you do call it quicker than other people do if you know you need to get that money. There really isn't anything wrong or illegal with calling right away. It shows a bit of cold or callousness, but that's in the eye of the beholder as well. If you're in a real shitty relationship and you're ready to have it be done, not through death, but you're ready, you know, divorce, and you're just, okay, I can't wait till this is over, you may not necessarily be in that super warm mindset of, I need a few more days to comprehend this. Maybe you already have. Maybe you've already done your grieving. And now, okay, well, there's money. Let's take it. Not a crime, but not that great of a look. How do you think it read to the jury?
Yeah, I think all of that is true. On top of that, my understanding is that Charles Vallow, the victim, was in the insurance industry, and Lori knew that, and they had set up, you know, insurance policies together. And so, you know, the fact that she had knowledge of this policy and thought she was the beneficiary, which she wasn't, had been changed, and then took steps to pursue that policy upon a person's death, that's what we would expect somebody to do. That's mm-hmm. that's sort of the legal process one would take. And so Lori, I think, really made a point several times in the trial to say, or to intimate that, hey, you know, me trying to find this insurance policy, that was just sort of par for the course. It was consistent with our dynamic and what Charles did. And there wasn't anything criminal about it. And I think she did a reasonably good job at conveying that to the jury.
Yeah, I agree. She did better than I certainly expected on that. We didn't really get to see anything good about Lori, though. And I'm one other than what she tried to present as herself. And that's what I'm wondering, how a jury is going to feel about it. The fact that she's not taking her turn as a defense. I'm wondering if that's going to come in closing arguments or an attempt at that in closing arguments. But it helps when you have a third party that's willing to go up there and say something nice, like she's a good mom or, you know, whatever. She makes delicious enchiladas. We learned that she makes her famous enchiladas every time the family got together, back when the family gave a shit about her. It's That's about it. It's like, oh, she makes great enchiladas and she's accused of murdering her ex-husband. But other than that, there isn't anyone. I'm wondering, what was there difficulty, you think, in her getting anyone to take the stand, to say anything good? Do you think she knew that anybody who was going to come up there wasn't necessarily going to be on her side, but yet she would be calling them as her own defense witness? How does that weigh to a jury when you only get one side saying this is a really shitty person, but we don't necessarily truly have the definitive let's do the hit on Charles other than code language? It is a lot of this that's going to be based on what they feel about Lori, and, you know, with not a clear smoking gun fact of a hit.
Tony, based on the letter of the law, the jury is only supposed to consider the evidence. They're not supposed to consider, you know, what kind of a person the defendant may be. But look, this is a murder trial. These jurors are human beings, and they are absolutely making observations and perceptions and judgments about the character of the defendant. Lori could have tried to call some witnesses to testify, for example, to a reputation for gentleness or for non-confrontation or something like that, if she had not already alienated all those folks out of her life. She did not do that, perhaps because she didn't know to do that. But the jury is left with kind of only one impression. And that's the impression given by the government, and it's not a good one.
The prosecution certainly did get the timeline out and, you know, kind of locked her into a corner. They showed that she was in contact with Chad, tried to get Social Security benefits the day after the murder, and then got married 4 months later. Obviously, she didn't go up to defend herself, but with closing arguments, if you were representing her, or if you were to be advising Lori of how to completely end this with her closing arguments, to counter that, what would you be telling her?
You know, I think you have to try and neutralize it. You have to sort of sanitize it from any criminal implication. And so, you know, you talk about, like I said, the fact that Charles Vela was in the insurance business. Lori knew of this policy. She was just doing what she was lawfully allowed to do, which is pursue it. And then, you know, marriages have turmoil. There's no surprise about that. The jurors would likely understand that. And so a person, you know, choosing to go with someone else with whom they were in love, even shortly after the dissolution of prior marriage and the death of the prior partner, is not unheard of, and it's not something that is criminal by any means. And that is sort of the direction I think a defense attorney would take in the closing argument. I can't wait to see how Lori styles.
I'm curious, and I'm also curious on this angle. In the opening statements, we saw a little emotion from Lori. We saw her cry, or appear to cry a little bit. I don't know if it was real or not, but she certainly, you know, checked that box or attempted to. I'm wondering if we're going to see some remorse or anything in the end here. Not a remorse in the sense of I did it and I feel really bad, but some remorse in the sense that, oh, my life got so turned upside down. My brother, you know, went too far. I mean, there is no throwing of Alex under the bus or really anything here. It's she's standing by him as this was completely justified. She could have gone down the road that, you know, I wasn't expecting this and he can't testify anymore. I'm kind of surprised she didn't go down that road at all. I was not part of this decision. Yeah, we were talking about Nephi, but we talk about religious things all the time. I misinterpreted that or something. Do you think we're going to see some more emotion in the closing arguments to try and play to the jury's, you know, that emotional side? She is a master manipulator. I'm just wondering how good she still is at it.
You know, if it could be a genuine expression of emotionality along the lines of what you said, like, hey, things weren't going great with Charles, but I'm devastated that my partner is gone and that, gosh, now my brother is gone. He was mixed up in this. This tore our family apart. That this was a horrible tragedy for us. And I really feel bad about everything involved, but it's not a crime. I think that would be necessary to kind of combat some of the other impressions. You see on the body cam, the day the police responded to Charles' death, at times, times Lori like has a smile on her face. She jokes around about a neighbor at one point, and that is just not the demeanor one would expect from a person who was innocently caught up in this interfamilial murder.
Mm-hmm. The fact that they also have, I mean, Ned, that was the part that did get in, that was kind of supernatural and weird, that he was possessed by, you know, Ned, I always say Ned Ryerson, because that's what I always think of with Groundhog Day. But Ned, I think he has a last name, but I don't remember. We got that in there. So you're dealing with someone who believes that her ex is possessed. She never even countered that. Not like, that's not what I meant. It was just not even addressed. I mean, that shows a very unstable human being. I mean, that shows someone who is not in the right mind. But, you know, this is taking place in Arizona. There still is, you know, a larger Mormon community out that direction that, you know, or even some pretty religious folks who may think that this is a real thing or believe that it's a real thing. Do you think anyone is going to buy in to believing that Lori thought her husband was possessed? I'm wondering if anybody else is going to go, oh, I've been there too. My uncle, you know, Ned was possessed. And we called him Larry.
You know, it's a significant part for the government's case, because they're trying to say, hey, that gave Lori the righteous moral justification in her mind to kill Charles, because she thought it wasn't even Charles anymore. It was like the zombie is named Ned. You know, that is, of course, extremely far-fetched. And I think that Lori should have considered a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, because that requires a person not know right from wrong. And here, what it seems, according to Lori, is that she thought she was doing right, and she was so spaced out that she didn't really understand the gravity of her actions, but no such defense was launched.
But could she do that offense in Arizona? Was that even an option? I know it wasn't in Idaho. I don't know that it was an option here, or if she would have chosen to go down it too, I wonder.
I'm not certain. Yeah. I practice out of Colorado, and most jurisdictions they have not guilty by reason of insanity, but there are requirements the court has for launching that defense, including sometimes evidentiary showings and expert analysis, and it sounds like none of that was conducted.
I'm wondering, should more states have that? From an attorney standpoint, is it something that is really more of a benefit to the court, to the accused, to the victims, to have something like that out there where you can make that plea? Like I said, I know Idaho does not have it. That's why nothing took place up there. It seems that it would save a lot of money. It would save a lot of headache. I mean, I wanted to put a ticker in the corner of the screen when this thing was going on, just how much wasted money is flying out every single minute that we're paying attention to Lori Vallow Daybell. How many lives are being interrupted? How much money is being lost with these people who can't go to work? And all of that, because that's a huge amount of money that totals up. And just the time that these people aren't going to get back, because we have to address the insanity of Lori Vallow Daybell. Should this be everywhere? Should every place have the option for an insanity defense? Because yes, there are people that are truly insane, and it doesn't know state lines. It is what it is, where it is.
You know, I think 100%, one of the court's objectives is to punish people who've done wrong and who know that they've done wrong. But when you have a person who is suffering from a mental disease or defect that is so profound that causes them to not know right from wrong, and then we just throw that person in a box, that's not really serving the court's rationale of punishing people who are knowingly committing wrongful acts. Mm-hmm. And so certainly I think every jurisdiction should have that if they don't already. And it is a frequent issue that arises in Colorado cases where I practice.
It is that it's a frequent issue where it's allowed. I find it interesting where some states kind of pretend it's not a thing at this day and age. So like, really? I feel like a lot of this could have been completely avoided had this existed there. She still actually technically has until Monday to decide whether or not she wants to do closing arguments. The judge said, I'll give you till Monday. If you choose to, you can still, or to run a defense, I should say, not closing arguments. Do you think we're going to see a change of heart here when she goes back to jail this weekend and she's, you know, sitting there in the knitting circle with her, you know, other accused friends that are on death row and such? Is somebody going to say, you know, you really should argue this, Lori? I'm wondering if there's going to be be a moment there of a change of heart?
You know, with Lori Vallow Daybell, anything is possible. Could she have an epiphany over the weekend and say, oh my gosh, I actually have to like come to my own defense and I've got to present something to this jury that would counter the narrative the prosecution has presented this entire trial? It's possible with her, and she's such a wild card that she's unpredictable. You don't know what she's going to do. And so I think everything's on the table still at this point.
I agree. I wouldn't put it past Lori to come back Monday and go, I had a vision, and the vision told me that I need to do this. Nephi came down. He came into, he was on the piece of toast I got from the commissary. His face was right there, and it said, Lori testified. She holds up a big piece of toast, and there's nothing on it. But
the hearsay objection there.
Exactly. She believes the toast inspired her to testify. It will certainly be very, very fascinating.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.